Chapter 6, The Demons and the Philosophers. I have dwelt at some little length on this imaginative sort of paganism, which has crowded the world with temples and is everywhere the parent of popular festivity. For the central history of civilization, as I see it, consists of two further stages before the final stage of Christendom. The first was the struggle between this paganism and something less worthy than itself, and the second, the process by which it grew in itself less worthy. In this very varied and often very vague polytheism, there was a weakness of original sin. Pagan gods were depicted as tossing men like dice, and indeed they are loaded dice. About sex, especially, men are born unbalanced. We might almost say men are born mad. They scarcely reach sanity till they reach sanctity. This disproportion dragged down the Wiccan fancies and filled the end of paganism with a mere filth and litter of spawning gods. But the first point to realize is that this sort of paganism had an early collusion with another sort of paganism, and that the issue of that essentially spiritual struggle really determined the history of the world. In order to understand it, we must pass to a review of the other kind of paganism. It can be considered much more briefly. Indeed, there is a very real sense in which the less that is said about it, the better. If we have called the first sort of mythology the daydream, we might very well call the second sort of mythology the nightmare. Superstition recurs in all ages, and especially in rationalistic ages. I remember defending the religious tradition against a whole luncheon table of distinguished agnostics, and before the end of our conversation, every one of them had procured from his pocket or exhibited on his watch chain some charm or talisman from which he admitted that he was never separated. I was the only person present who had neglected to provide himself with a fetish. Superstition recurs in a rationalist age because it rests on something which, if not identical with rationalism, is not unconnected with skepticism. It is, at least, very closely connected with agnosticism. It rests on something that is really a very human and intelligible sentiment, like the local invocations of the Newman in popular paganism. But it is an agnostic sentiment, for it rests on two feelings. First, that we do not really know the laws of the universe, and second, that they may be very different to all we call reason. Such men realize the real truth that enormous things do often turn upon tiny things. When a whisper comes from tradition or whatnot that one particular tiny thing is the key or clue, something deep and not altogether senseless in human nature tells them that it is not unlikely. This feeling exists in both the forms of paganism here under consideration. But when we come to the second form of it, we find it transformed and filled with another and more terrible spirit. In dealing with the lighter thing called mythology, I have said little about the most disputable aspect of it, the extent to which such invocation of the spirits of the sea or the elements can indeed call spirits from the vasty deep, or rather, as the Shakespearean scoffer put it, whether the spirits come when they are called. I believe that I am right in thinking that this problem, practical as it sounds, did not play a dominant part in the poetical business of mythology. But I think it even more obvious on the evidence that things of that sort have sometimes appeared, even if they were only appearances. But when we come to the world of superstition, in a more subtle sense, there is a shade of difference, a deepening and a darkening shade. Doubtless, most popular superstition is as frivolous as any popular mythology. Men do not believe as a dogma that God would throw a thunderbolt at them for walking under a ladder. More often, they amuse themselves with a not very laborious exercise of walking round it. There is no more in it than what I have already adumbrated, a sort of airy agnosticism about the possibilities of so strange a world. But there is another sort of superstition that does definitely look for results, what might be called a realistic superstition. And with that, the question of whether spirits do answer or do appear becomes much more serious. As I have said, It seems to me pretty certain that they sometimes do. But about that, there is a distinction that has been the beginning of much evil in the world. Whether it is because the fall has really brought men nearer to less desirable neighbors in the spiritual world, or whether it is merely that the mood of men, eager or greedy, finds it easier to imagine evil, I believe that the black magic of witchcraft has been much more practical and much less poetical than the white magic of mythology. I fancy the garden of the witch has been kept much more carefully than the woodland of the nymph. I fancy the evil field has even been more fruitful than the good. To start with, some impulse, perhaps a sort of desperate impulse, drove men to the darker powers when dealing with practical problems. There was a sort of secret and perverse feeling that the darker powers would really do things that they had no nonsense about them, and indeed that popular phrase exactly expresses the point. The gods of mere mythology had a great deal of nonsense about them. They had a great deal of good nonsense about them, in the happy and hilarious sense in which we talk of the nonsense of Jabberwocky, or the land where Jumblies live. But the man consulting a demon felt as many a man has felt in consulting a detective, especially a private detective, that it was dirty work, but the work would really be done. A man did not exactly go into the wood to meet a nymph. He rather went with the hope of meeting a nymph. It was an adventure rather than an assignation. But the devil really kept his appointments and even in one sense kept his promises. Even if a man sometimes wished afterwards, like Macbeth, that he had broken them. In the accounts given us of many rude or savage races, we gather that the cult of demons often came after the cult of deities, and even after the cult of one single and supreme deity. It may be suspected that in almost all such places, the higher deity is felt to be too far off for appeal in certain petty matters, and men invoke the spirits because they are, in a more literal sense, familiar spirits. But with the idea of employing the demons who get things done, a new idea appears more worthy of the demons. It may indeed be truly described as the idea of being worthy of the demons, of making oneself fit for their fastidious and exacting society. Superstition of the lighter sort toys with the idea that some trifle, some small gesture, such as throwing the salt, may touch the hidden spring that works the mysterious machinery of the world. And there is, after all, something in the idea of such an open sesame. But with the appeal to lower spirits comes the horrible notion that the gesture must not only be very small, but very low, that it must be a monkey trick of an utterly ugly and unworthy sort. Sooner or later, a man deliberately sets himself to do the most disgusting thing he can think of. It is felt that the extreme of evil will extort a sort of attention or answer from the evil powers under the surface of the world. This is the meaning of most of the cannibalism in the world, for most cannibalism is not a primitive or even a bestial habit. It is artificial and even artistic, a sort of art for art's sake. Men do not do it because they do not think it horrible, but on the contrary, because they do think it horrible. They wish, in the most literal sense, to sup on horrors. That is why it is often found that rude races like the Australian natives are not cannibals, while much more refined and intelligent races like the New Zealand Maoris occasionally are. They are refined and intelligent enough to indulge sometimes in a self-conscious diabolism. But if we could understand their minds, or even really understand their language, we should probably find that they were not acting as ignorant, that is, as innocent cannibals. They are not doing it because they do not think it wrong, but precisely because they do think it wrong. They are acting like a Parisian decadent at a black mass, but the black mass has to hide underground from the presence of the real mass. In other words, the demons have really been hiding since the coming of Christ on earth. The cannibalism of the higher barbarians is in hiding from the civilization of the white man. But before Christendom, and especially outside Europe, this was not always so. In the ancient world, the demons often wandered abroad like dragons. They could be positively and publicly enthroned as gods. Their enormous images could be set up in public temples in the center of populous cities. And all over the world, the traces can be found of this striking and solid fact, so curiously overlooked by the moderns who speak of all such evil as primitive and early in evolution, that, as a matter of fact, some of the very highest civilizations of the world were the very places where the horns of Satan were exalted not only to the stars, but in the face of the sun. Take, for example, the Aztecs and American Indians of the ancient empires of Mexico and Peru. They were at least as elaborate as Egypt or China, and only less lively than the central civilization which is our own. But those who criticize that central civilization, which is always their own civilization, have a curious habit of not merely doing their legitimate duty in condemning its crimes, but of going out of their way to idealize its victims. They always assume that before the advent of Europe, there was nothing anywhere but Eden. And Swinburne, in that spirited chorus of the nations in Songs Before Sunrise, used an expression about Spain in her South American conquests which always struck me as very strange. He said something about her sins and sons through sinless lands dispersed, and how they made a curse the name of man and thrice a curse the name of God. It may be reasonable enough that he should say the Spaniards were sinful, but why in the world should he say that the South Americans were sinless? Why should he have supposed that continent to be exclusively populated by archangels or saints, perfect in heaven? It would be a strong thing to say of the most respectable neighborhood, but when we come to think of what we really do know of that society, the remark is rather funny. We know that the sinless priests of this sinless people worshipped sinless gods who accepted as the nectar and ambrosia of their sunny paradise nothing but incessant human sacrifice, accompanied by horrible torments. We may note also in the mythology of this American civilization that element of reversal or violence against instinct of which Dante wrote, which runs backwards everywhere through the unnatural religion of the demons. It is notable not only in ethics, but in aesthetics. A South American idol was made as ugly as possible, as a Greek image was made as beautiful as possible. They were seeking the secret of power by working backwards against their own nature and the nature of things. There was always a sort of yearning to carve at last in gold or granite or the dark red timber of the forests a face at which the sky itself would break like a cracked mirror. In any case, it is clear enough that the painted and gilded civilization of tropical America systematically indulged in human sacrifice. It is by no means clear, so far as I know, that the Eskimos ever indulged in human sacrifice. They were not civilized enough. They were too closely imprisoned by the white winter and the endless dark. Chill penury repressed their noble rage and froze the genial current of the soul. It was in brighter days and broader daylight that the noble rage is found unmistakably raging. It was in richer and more instructed lands that the genial current flowed on the altars to be drunk by great gods, wearing goggling and grinning masks and called on in terror or torment by long cacophonous names that sound like laughter in hell. A warmer climate and a more scientific cultivation were needed to bring forth these blooms, to draw up towards the sun the large leaves and flamboyant blossoms that gave their golden, crimson, and purple to that garden which Swinburne compares to the Hesperides. There was at least no doubt about the dragon. I do not raise in this connection a special controversy about Spain and Mexico, but I may remark in passing that it resembles exactly the question that must in some sense be raised afterwards about Rome and Carthage. In both cases, There has been a queer habit among the English of always siding against the Europeans and representing the rival civilization, in Swinburne's phrase, as sinless, when its sins were obviously crying, or rather screaming, to heaven. For Carthage was also a high civilization, indeed a much more highly civilized civilization. And Carthage also founded that civilization on a religion of fear, sending up everywhere the smoke of human sacrifice. Now, it is very right to rebuke our own race or religion for falling short of our own standards and ideals, but it is absurd to pretend that they fell lower than the other races and religions that profess the very opposite standards and ideals. There is a very real sense in which the Christian is worse than the heathen, the Spaniard worse than the Red Indian, or even the Roman, potentially worse than the Carthaginian. But there is only one sense in which he is worse, and that is not in being positively worse. The Christian is only worse because it is his business to be better. This inverted imagination produces things of which it is better not to speak. Some of them, indeed, might almost be named without being known, for they are of that extreme evil which seems innocent to the innocent. They are too inhuman, even to be indecent. But without dwelling much longer in these dark corners, it may be noted as not irrelevant here that certain anti-human antagonisms seem to recur in this tradition of black magic. There may be suspected as running through it everywhere, for instance, a mystical hatred of the idea of childhood. People would understand better the popular fury against the witches if they remembered that the malice most commonly attributed to them was preventing the birth of children. The Hebrew prophets were perpetually protesting against the Hebrew race relapsing into an idolatry that involved such a war upon children, and it is probable enough that this abominable apostasy from the God of Israel has occasionally appeared in Israel since in the form of what is called ritual murder, not, of course, by any representative of the religion of Judaism, but by individual and irresponsible diabolists who did happen to be Jews. The sense that the forces of evil especially threaten childhood is found again in the enormous popularity of the child martyr of the Middle Ages. Chaucer did but give another version of a very national English legend when he conceived the wickedest of all possible witches as the dark alien woman, watching behind her high lattice and hearing like the babble of a brook down the stony street the singing of little St. Hugh. Anyhow, the part of such speculations that concerns this story centered especially round that eastern end of the Mediterranean where the nomads had turned gradually into traders and had begun to trade with the whole world. Indeed, in the sense of trade and travel and colonial extension, it already had something like an empire of the whole world. Its purple dye, the emblem of its rich pomp and luxury, had steeped the wares which were sold far away amid the last crags of Cornwall and the sails that entered the silence of tropic seas amid all the mystery of Africa. It might be said truly to have painted the map purple. It was already a worldwide success when the princes of Tyre would hardly have troubled to notice that one of their princesses had condescended to marry the chief of some tribe called Judah, when the merchants of its African outpost would only have curled their bearded and Semitic lips with a slight smile at the mention of a village called Rome. And indeed no two things could have seemed more distant from each other, not only in space but in spirit, than the monotheism of the Palestinian tribe and the very virtues of the small Italian republic. There was but one thing between them, and the thing which divided them has united them. Very various and incompatible with the things that could be loved by the consuls of Rome and the prophets of Israel, but they were at one in what they hated. It is very easy in both cases to represent that hatred as something merely hateful. It is easy enough to make a merely harsh and inhuman figure, either of Elijah raving about the slaughter of Carmel or Cato thundering against the amnesty of Africa. These men had their limitations and their local passions, but this criticism of them is unimaginative and therefore unreal. It leaves out something immense and intermediate, facing east and west, and calling up this passion and its eastern and western enemies, and that something is the first subject of this chapter. A civilization that centered in Tyre and Sidon was above all things practical. It has left little in the way of art and nothing in the way of poetry, but it prided itself upon being very efficient. And it followed in its philosophy and religion that strange and sometimes secret train of thought which we have already noted in those who look for immediate effects. There is always in such a mentality an idea that there is a shortcut to the secret of all success, something that would shock the world by this sort of shameless thoroughness. They believed in the appropriate modern phrase, in people who delivered the goods. In their dealings with their god Moloch, they themselves were always careful to deliver the goods. It was an interesting transaction, upon which we shall have to touch more than once in the rest of the narrative. It is enough to say here that it involved the theory I have suggested about a certain attitude towards children. This was what called up against it in simultaneous fury the servant of one god in Palestine and the guardians of all the household gods in Rome. This is what challenged two things naturally so much divided by every sort of distance and disunion, whose union was to save the world. I have called the fourth and final division of the spiritual elements into which I should divide heathen humanity by the name of the philosophers. I confess that it covers in my mind much that would generally be classified otherwise, and that what are here called philosophies are very often called religions. I believe, however, that my own description will be found to be much the more realistic and not the less respectful. But we must first take philosophy in its purest and clearest form, that we may trace its normal outline, and that is to be found in the world of the purest and clearest outlines, that culture of the Mediterranean of which we have been considering the mythologies and idolatries in the last two chapters. Polytheism, or that aspect of paganism, was never to the pagan what Catholicism is to the Catholic. It was never a view of the universe satisfying all sides of life, a complete and complex truth with something to say about everything. It was only a satisfaction of one side of the soul of man, even if we call it the religious side, and I think it is truer to call it the imaginative side. But this it did satisfy. In the end, it satisfied it to satiety. All that world was a tissue of interwoven tales and cults, and there ran in and out of it, as we have already seen, that black thread among its more blameless colors, the darker paganism that was really diabolism. But we all know that this did not mean that all pagan men thought of nothing but pagan gods. Precisely because mythology only satisfied one mood, they turned in other moods to something totally different. But it is very important to realize that it was totally different. It was too different to be inconsistent. It was so alien that it did not clash. While a mob of people were pouring on a public holiday to the feast of Adonis or the games in honor of Apollo, this or that man would prefer to stop at home and think out a little theory about the nature of things. Sometimes his hobby would even take the form of thinking about the nature of God, or even in that sense about the nature of the gods. But he very seldom thought of pitting his nature of the gods against the gods of nature. It is necessary to insist on this abstraction in the first student of abstraction. He was not so much antagonistic as absent-minded. His hobby might be the universe, but at first the hobby was as private as if it had been numismatics or playing drafts. And even when his wisdom came to be a public possession and almost a political institution, it was very seldom on the same plane as the popular and religious institutions. Aristotle, with his colossal common sense, was perhaps the greatest of all philosophers, certainly the most practical of all philosophers. But Aristotle could no more have set up the absolute side by side with the Apollo of Delphi as a similar or rival religion than Archimedes would have thought of setting up the lever as a sort of idol or fetish to be substituted for the palladium of the city. Or we might as well imagine Euclid building an altar to an isosceles triangle, or offering sacrifices to the square of the hypotenuse. The one man meditated on metaphysics as the other man did on mathematics, for the love of truth, or for curiosity, or for the fun of the thing. But that sort of fun never seems to have interfered very much with the other sort of fun, the fun of dancing or singing to celebrate some rascally romance about Zeus becoming a bull or a swan. It is perhaps the proof of a certain superficiality and even insincerity about the popular polytheism that men could be philosophers and even skeptics without disturbing it. These thinkers could move the foundations of the world without altering even the outline of that colored cloud that hung above it in the air. For the thinkers did move the foundations of the world, even when a curious compromise seemed to prevent them from moving the foundations of the city. The two great philosophers of antiquity do indeed appear to us as defenders of sane and even of sacred ideas. Their maxims often read like the answers to skeptical questions, too completely answered to be always recorded. Aristotle annihilated 100 anarchists and nature-worshipping cranks by the fundamental statement that man is a political animal. Plato, in some sense, anticipated the Catholic realism as attacked by the heretical nominalism by insisting on the equally fundamental fact that ideas are realities, that ideas exist just as men exist. Plato, however, seemed sometimes almost to fancy that ideas exist as men do not exist, or that the men need hardly be considered where they conflict with the ideas. He had something of the social sentiment that we call Fabian in his ideal of fitting the citizen to the city like an imaginary head to an ideal hat. And great and glorious as he remains, he has been the father of all faddists. Aristotle anticipated more fully the sacramental sanity that was to combine the body and the soul of things, for he considered the nature of men as well as the nature of morals, and looked to the eyes as well as to the light. But though these great men were in that sense constructive and conservative, they belonged to a world where thought was free to the point of being fanciful. Many other great intellects did indeed follow them, some exalting an abstract vision of virtue, others following more rationalistically the necessity of the human pursuit of happiness. The former had the name of Stoics, and their name has passed into a proverb for what is indeed one of the main moral ideals of mankind, that of strengthening the mind itself until it is of a texture to resist calamity or even pain. But it is admitted that a great number of the philosophers degenerated into what we still call sophists. They became a sort of professional skeptics who went about asking uncomfortable questions and were handsomely paid for making themselves a nuisance to normal people. It was perhaps an accidental resemblance to such questioning quacks that was responsible for the unpopularity of the great Socrates, whose death might seem to contradict the suggestion of the permanent truce between the philosophers and the gods. But Socrates did not die as a monotheist who denounced polytheism, certainly not as a prophet who denounced idols. It is clear to anyone reading between the lines that there was some notion, right or wrong, of a purely personal influence affecting morals and, perhaps, politics. The general compromise remained, whether it was that the Greeks thought their myths a joke or that they thought their theories a joke. There was never any collision in which one really destroyed the other, and there was never any combination in which one was really reconciled with the other. They certainly did not work together. If anything, the philosopher was a rival of the priest. But both seemed to have accepted a sort of separation of functions and remained parts of the same social system. Another important tradition descends from Pythagoras, who is significant because he stands nearest to the Oriental mystics who must be considered in their turn. He taught a sort of mysticism of mathematics, that number is the ultimate reality. But he also seems to have taught the transmigration of souls, like the Brahmins, and to have left to his followers certain traditional tricks of vegetarianism and water drinking, very common among the Eastern sages, especially those who figure in fashionable drawing rooms, like those of the later Roman Empire. But in passing to Eastern stages and the somewhat different atmosphere of the East, we may approach a rather important truth by another path. One of the great philosophers said that it would be well if philosophers were kings, or kings were philosophers. He spoke as of something too good to be true, but, as a matter of fact, it not unfrequently was true. A certain type, perhaps too little noticed in history, may really be called the royal philosopher. To begin with, apart from actual royalty, it did occasionally become possible for the sage, though he was not what we call a religious founder, to be something like a political founder. And the great example of this, one of the very greatest in the world, will, with the very thought of it, carry us thousands of miles across the vast spaces of Asia to that very wonderful and, in some ways, that very wise world of ideas and institutions which we dismiss somewhat cheaply when we talk of China. Men have served many very strange gods and trusted themselves loyally to many ideals and even idols. China is a society that has really chosen to believe in intellect. It has taken intellect seriously, and it may be that it stands alone in the world. From a very early age, it faced the dilemma of the king and the philosopher by actually appointing a philosopher to advise the king. It made a public institution out of a private individual who had nothing in the world to do but to be intellectual. It had, and has, of course, many other things on the same pattern. It creates all ranks and privileges by public examination. It has nothing that we call an aristocracy. It is a democracy dominated by an intelligentsia. But the point here is that it had philosophers to advise kings. One of those philosophers must have been a great philosopher and a great statesman. Confucius was not a religious founder or even a religious teacher, possibly not even a religious man. He was not an atheist. He was, apparently, what we call an agnostic. But the really vital point is that it is utterly irrelevant to talk about his religion at all. It is like talking of theology as the first thing in the story of how Rowland Hill established the postal system, or Baden-Powell organized the Boy Scouts. Confucius was not here to bring a message from heaven to humanity, but to organize China. And he must have organized it exceedingly well. It follows that he dealt much with morals, but he bound them up strictly with manners. The peculiarity of his scheme and of his country, in which it contrasts with its great pedant, the system of Christendom, is that he insisted on perpetuating an external life with all its forms, that outward continuity might preserve internal peace. Anyone who knows how much habit has to do with health of mind as well as body will see the truth in his idea. But he will also see that the ancestor worship and the reverence for the sacred emperor were habits and not creeds. It is unfair to the great Confucius to say he was a religious founder. It is even unfair to him to say he was not a religious founder. It is as unfair as going out of one's way to say that Jeremy Bentham was not a Christian martyr. But there is a class of most interesting cases in which philosophers were kings and not merely the friends of kings. The combination is not accidental. It has a great deal to do with this rather elusive question of the function of the philosopher. It contains in it some hint of why philosophy and mythology seldom came to an open rupture. It was not only because there was something a little frivolous about the mythology, it was also because there was something a little supercilious about the philosopher. He despised the myths, but he also despised the mob, and thought they suited each other. The pagan philosopher was seldom a man of the people, at any rate in spirit. He was seldom a democrat, and often a bitter critic of democracy. He had about him an air of aristocratic and humane leisure, and his part was mostly played by men who happened to be in such a position. It was very easy and natural for a prince or a prominent person to play at being as philosophical as Hamlet or Theseus in the Midsummer Night's Dream. And from very early ages, we find ourselves in the presence of these princely intellectuals. In fact, we find one of them in the very first recorded ages of the world, sitting on the primeval throne that looked over ancient Egypt. The most intense interest of the incident of Akhenaten, commonly called the heretic pharaoh, lies in the fact that he was the one example, at any rate before Christian times, of one of these royal philosophers who set himself to fight popular mythology in the name of private philosophy. Most of them assumed the attitude of Marcus Aurelius, who is in many ways the model of this sort of monarch and sage. Marcus Aurelius has been blamed for tolerating the pagan amphitheater or the Christian martyrdoms, but it was characteristic, for this sort of man really thought of popular religion just as he thought of popular circuses. Of him, Professor Fillmore has profoundly said, "A great and good man," and he knew it. The heretic pharaoh had a philosophy more earnest and perhaps more humble, for there is a corollary to the conception of being too proud to fight. It is that the humble have to do most of the fighting. Anyhow, the Egyptian prince was simple enough to take his own philosophy seriously, and alone among such intellectual princes, he effected a sort of coup d'etat, hurling down the high gods of Egypt with one imperial gesture and lifting up for all men like a blazing mirror of monotheistic truth the disk of the universal sun. He had other interesting ideas, often to be found in such idealists. In the sense in which we speak of a little Englander, he was a little Egypter. In art, he was a realist because he was an idealist, for realism is more impossible than any other ideal. But after all, there falls on him something of the shadow of Marcus Aurelius, stalked by the shadow of Professor Fillmore. What is the matter with this noble sort of prince is that he has nowhere quite escaped being something of a prig. Priggishness is so pungent a smell that it clings amid the faded spices even to an Egyptian mummy. What was the matter with the heretic pharaoh, as with a good many other heretics, was that he probably never paused to ask himself whether there was anything in the popular beliefs and tales of people less educated than himself. And, as already suggested, there was something in them. There was a real human hunger in all that element of feature and locality, that procession of deities, like enormous pet animals, in that unwearied watching at certain haunted spots, in all the mazy wandering of mythology. Nature may not have the name of Isis. Isis may not be really looking for Osiris, but it is true that nature is really looking for something. Nature is always looking for the supernatural. Something much more definite was to satisfy that need, but a dignified monarch with a disk of the sun did not satisfy it. The royal experiment failed amid a roaring reaction of popular superstitions in which the priests rose on the shoulders of the people and ascended the throne of the kings. The next great example I shall take of the princely sage is Gautama, the great Lord Buddha. I know he is not generally classed merely with the philosophers, but I am more and more convinced from all information that reaches me that this is the real interpretation of his immense importance. He was by far the greatest and the best of these intellectuals born in the purple. His reaction was perhaps the noblest and most sincere of all the resultant actions of that combination of thinkers and thrones. For his reaction was renunciation. Marcus Aurelius was content to say with a refined irony that even in a palace life could be lived well. The fierier Egyptian king concluded that it could be lived even better after a palace revolution. But the great Gautama was the only one of them who proved he could really do without his palace. One fell back on toleration, and the other on revolution. But after all, there is something more absolute about abdication. Abdication is perhaps the one really absolute action of an absolute monarch. The Indian prince, reared in oriental luxury and pomp, deliberately went out and lived the life of a beggar. This is magnificent, but it is not war. That is, it is not necessarily a crusade in the Christian sense. It does not decide the question of whether the life of a beggar was the life of a saint or the life of a philosopher. It does not decide whether this great man is really to go into the tub of Diogenes or the cave of St. Jerome. Now, those who seem to be nearest to the study of Buddha, and certainly those who write most clearly and intelligently about him, convince me, for one, that he was simply a philosopher who founded a successful school of philosophy and was turned into a sort of divus, or sacred being, merely by the more mysterious and unscientific atmosphere of all such traditions in Asia. So that it is necessary to say at this point a word about that invisible yet vivid border line that we cross in passing from the Mediterranean into the mystery of the East. Perhaps there are no things out of which we get so little of the truth as the truisms, especially when they are really true. We are all in the habit of saying certain things about Asia, which are true enough, but which hardly help us because we do not understand their truth, as that Asia is old or looks to the past or is not progressive. Now, it is true that Christendom is more progressive in a sense that has very little to do with the rather provincial notion of an endless fuss of political improvement. Christendom does believe, or Christianity does believe, that man can eventually get somewhere, here or hereafter, or in various ways according to various doctrines. The world's desire can somehow be satisfied as desires are satisfied, whether by a new life or an old love, for some form of positive possession and fulfillment. For the rest, we all know there is a rhythm and not a mere progress in things, that things rise and fall. Only with us the rhythm is a fairly free and incalculable rhythm. For most of Asia, the rhythm has hardened into a recurrence. It is no longer merely a rather topsy-turvy sort of world. It is a wheel. What has happened to all those highly intelligent and highly civilized peoples is that they have been caught up in a sort of cosmic rotation, of which the hollow hub is really nothing. In that sense, the worst part of existence is that it may just as well go on like that forever. That is what we really mean when we say that Asia is old or unprogressive or looking backwards. That is why we see even her curved swords as arcs broken from that blinding wheel. Why we see her serpentine ornament as returning everywhere like a snake that is never slain. It has very little to do with the political varnish of progress. All Asiatics might have top hats on their heads, but if they had this spirit still in their hearts, they would only think the hats would vanish and come round again like the planets. Not that running after a hat could lead them to heaven or even to home. Now, when the genius of Buddha arose to deal with the matter, the sort of cosmic sentiment was already common to almost everything in the East. There was indeed the jungle of an extraordinarily extravagant and almost asphyxiating mythology. Nevertheless, it is possible to have more sympathy with this popular fruitfulness in folklore than with some of the higher pessimism that might have withered it. It must always be remembered, however, when all fair allowances are made, that a great deal of spontaneous Eastern imagery really is idolatry, the local and literal worship of an idol. This is probably not true of the ancient Brahminical system, at least as seen by Brahmins. But that phrase alone will remind us of a reality of much greater moment. This great reality is the caste system of ancient India. It may have had some of the practical advantages of the guild system of medieval Europe, but it contrasts not only with that Christian democracy, but with every extreme type of Christian aristocracy in the fact that it does really conceive the social superiority as a spiritual superiority. This not only divides it fundamentally from the fraternity of Christendom, but leaves it standing like a mighty and terraced mountain of pride between the relatively egalitarian levels both of Islam and of China. But the fixity of this formation through thousands of years is another illustration of that spirit of repetition that has marked time from time immemorial. Now, we may also presume the prevalence of another idea which we associate with the Buddhists as interpreted by the Theosophists. As a fact, some of the strictest Buddhists repudiate the idea and still more scornfully repudiate the Theosophists. But whether the idea is in Buddhism, or only in the birthplace of Buddhism, or only in a tradition or a travesty of Buddhism, it is an idea entirely proper to this principle of recurrence. I mean, of course, the idea of reincarnation. But reincarnation is not really a mystical idea. It is not really a transcendental idea, or in that sense, a religious idea. Mysticism conceives something transcending experience. Religion seeks glimpses of a better good or a worse evil than experience can give. Reincarnation need only extend experiences in the sense of repeating them. It is no more transcendental for a man to remember what he did in Babylon before he was born than to remember what he did in Brixton before he had a knock on the head. His successive lives need not be any more than human lives under whatever limitations burden human life. It has nothing to do with seeing God or even conjuring up the devil. In other words, reincarnation as such does not necessarily escape from the wheel of destiny. In some sense, it is the wheel of destiny. And whether it was something that Buddha founded or something that Buddha found or something that Buddha entirely renounced when he found, it is certainly something having the general character of that Asiatic atmosphere in which he had to play his part. And the part he played was that of an intellectual philosopher with a particular theory about the right intellectual attitude towards it. I can understand that Buddhists might resent the view that Buddhism is merely a philosophy, if we understand by a philosophy merely an intellectual game such as Greek sophists played, tossing up worlds and catching them like balls. Perhaps a more exact statement would be that Buddha was a man who made a metaphysical discipline, which might even be called a psychological discipline. He proposed a way of escaping from all this recurrent sorrow, and that was simply by getting rid of the delusion that is called desire. It was emphatically not that we should get what we want better by restraining our impatience for part of it, or that we should get it in a better way or in a better world. It was emphatically that we should leave off wanting it. If once a man realized that there is really no reality, that everything, including his soul, is in dissolution at every instant, he would anticipate disappointment and be intangible to change existing insofar as he could be said to exist in a sort of ecstasy of indifference. The Buddhists call this beatitude. And we will not stop our story to argue the point. Certainly to us, it is indistinguishable from despair. I do not see, for instance, why the disappointment of desire should not apply as much to the most benevolent desires as to the most selfish ones. Indeed, the Lord of Compassion seems to pity people for living rather than for dying. For the rest, an intelligent Buddhist wrote, "The explanation of popular Chinese and Japanese Buddhism is that it is not Buddhism. That has doubtless ceased to be a mere philosophy, but only by becoming a mere mythology. One thing is certain, it has never become anything remotely resembling what we call a church. It will appear only a jest to say that all religious history has really been a pattern of noughts and crosses. But I do not by noughts mean nothings, but only things that are negative compared with a positive shape or pattern of the other. And though the symbol is, of course, only a coincidence, it is a coincidence that really does coincide. The mind of Asia can really be represented by a round O, if not in the sense of a cipher, at least of a circle. The great Asiatic symbol of a serpent with its tail in its mouth is really a very perfect image of a certain idea of unity and recurrence that does indeed belong to the Eastern philosophies and religions. It really is a curve that in one sense includes everything and in another sense comes to nothing. In that sense, it does confess, or rather boast, that all argument is an argument in a circle. And though the figure is but a symbol, we can see how sound is the symbolic sense that produces it, the parallel symbol of the wheel of Buddha, generally called the swastika. The cross is a thing at right angles, pointing boldly in opposite directions, but the swastika is the same thing in the very act of returning to the recurrent curve. That crooked cross is, in fact, a cross turning into a wheel. Before we dismiss even these symbols as if they were arbitrary symbols, we must remember how intense was the imaginative instinct that produced them or selected them both in the East and the West. The cross has become something more than a historical memory. It does convey, almost as by a mathematical diagram, the truth about the real point at issue, the idea of a conflict stretching outwards into eternity. It is true and even tautological to say that the cross is the crux of the whole matter. In other words, the cross, in fact as well as figure, does really stand for the idea of breaking out of the circle that is everything and nothing. It does escape from the circular argument by which everything begins and ends in the mind. Since we are still dealing in symbols, it might be put in a parable in the form of that story about St. Francis, which says that the birds, departing with his benediction, could wing their way into the infinities of the four winds of heaven, their tracks making a vast cross upon the sky. For compared with the freedom of that flight of birds, the very shape of the swastika is like a kitten chasing its tail. In a more popular allegory, we might say that when St. George thrust his spear into the monster's jaws, he broke in upon the solitude of the self-devouring serpent and gave it something to bite besides its own tail. But while many fancies might be used as figures of the truth itself is abstract and absolute, though it is not very easy to sum up except by such figures. Christianity does appeal to a solid truth outside itself, to something which is in that sense external as well as eternal. It does declare that things are really there, or in other words, that things are really things. In this, Christianity is at one with common sense, but all religious history shows that this common sense perishes, except where there is Christianity to preserve it. It cannot otherwise exist or at least endure because mere thought does not remain sane. In a sense, it becomes too simple to be sane. The temptation of the philosophers is simplicity rather than subtlety. They are always attracted by insane simplifications. As men poised above abysses are fascinated by death and nothingness and the empty air. It needed another kind of philosopher to stand poised upon the pinnacle of the temple and keep his balance without casting himself down. One of these two obvious explanations is that everything is a dream and a delusion and there is nothing outside the ego. Another is that all things recur. Another, which is said to be Buddhist and is certainly Oriental, is the idea that what is the matter with us is our creation, in the sense of our color differentiation and personality, and that nothing will be well till we are again melted into one unity. By this theory, in short, the creation was the fall. It is important historically because it was stored up in the dark heart of Asia and went forth at various times in various forms over the dim borders of Europe. Here we can place the mysterious figure of Manes or Manichaeus, the mystic of inversion, whom we should call a pessimist, parent of many sects and heresies. Here in a higher place, the figure of Zoroaster. He has been popularly identified with another of these two simple explanations, the equality of evil and good, balanced and battling in every atom. He also is of the school of sages that may be called mystics, and from the same mysterious Persian garden came upon ponderous wings Mithras, the unknown god, to trouble the last twilight of Rome. That circle or disk of the sun, set up in the morning of the world by the remote Egyptian, has been a mirror and a model for all the philosophers. They have made many things out of it and sometimes gone mad about it, especially when, as in these Eastern sages, the circle became a wheel going round and round in their heads. But the point about them is that they all think that existence can be represented by a diagram instead of a drawing. And the rude drawings of the childish myth-makers are a sort of crude and spirited protest against that view. They cannot believe that religion is really not a pattern, but a picture. Still less can they believe that it is a picture of something that really exists outside our minds. Sometimes the philosopher paints the disc all black and calls himself a pessimist. Sometimes he paints it all white and calls himself an optimist. Sometimes he divides it exactly into halves of black and white and calls himself a dualist, like those Persian mystics to whom I wish there were space to do justice. None of them could understand a thing that began to draw the proportions just as if they were real proportions, disposed in the living fashion which the mathematical draftsman would call disproportionate. Like the first artist in the cave, it revealed to incredulous eyes the suggestion of a new purpose in what looked like a wildly crooked pattern. He seemed only to be distorting his diagram when he began for the first time in all the ages to trace the lines of a form and of a face.